Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwarzschreiber. On today's show, Uber, the topic that never ends. We've talked on this show about Austin and Massachusetts and California and some of the regulatory battles that the company has gone through in the United States. But today we're taking the show international. We're going to talk about some battles in London and Montreal. And who better to discuss international policy than an American? So joining me to discuss this is Jared Meyer, research fellow at the Manhattan Institute and author of Uber Positive, Why Americans Love the Sharing Economy. Jared, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me, Evan.
You know, it's been a while since you've been on the show, Jared. I think listeners have been going through withdrawal, you know, to hear the soothing sound of your voice, which is also the voice of a generation, the voice of millennials.
And a shill for Uber, but a lot of different things going on.
You said it, not me. But now that we've poisoned the well, let's get on to the show. So Jared, what's going on in London? Recently, the mayor, Sadiq Khan, promised to bring back the resurgence of the black taxis. And listeners, if you haven't been to London or watched any movies that take place in London, unlikely, but just like the yellow cab in New York is a symbol, the black taxi in London is a symbol. And the mayor recently said, quote, "I will be a mayor that begins the renaissance of the black taxis. They're iconic. We saw the closing ceremony at the Olympics. What a role they had. I don't want the black taxi to go the way of the red telephone box," end quote. So Jared, is this a good idea? What exactly is he proposing?
Well, we should always make government policy on what's cute and what we want to preserve from earlier generations. But no, if you look at Mayor Khan's statement, if you Boris Johnson in the past, the previous mayor of London, he said a lot of things about Uber that were pretty negative as well, but he never actually followed through. And London's one of the best markets in Western Europe for Uber when you're going up against the likes of, let's say, France.
And the previous mayor, Boris Johnson, he was a member of the Conservative Party, the Tory Party, and now the current mayor is a Labour Party member, correct?
Yes, yeah, they switched over representation. And you can see with Khan's views, he's clearly in the established taxi drivers' pockets. He came with an idea to put the brakes on ride sharing and really boost the taxi industry. And that's exactly what he does with his new 27-point plan about modernizing the taxi industry.
And it's interesting that you point out that there are 27 points because prior to that, the taxi industry had a 28-point wish list. I mean, is he basically a 27 for 28 on delivering to the taxi industry exactly what it wants?
It's not direct overlap, but if you read the two lists, there are some striking similarities, and the taxis pretty much got everything they wanted, except for an outright ban
on Uber. So let's start with what stood out to you the most about the 27-point plan. What does it do to ride-sharing? What does it do to Uber?
Well, what it does is start to shift the scale to where you're going to be treating ride sharing much more like the black cab industry. They're trying to erase the lines between how these two industries operate. And while they don't have a direct ban, the drivers are going to have to follow certain things like English language requirements and get special insurance that's much more expensive, and also have to take advanced driving tests and map tests, which kind of brings up the knowledge. A lot of people hear about it because it's so insane, but in taxi cab drivers in London, they have to study about 3 to 5 years, and they have a very low pass rate of practically memorizing everything in the entire city. They're bringing a slimmed down version of that to ride sharing drivers now.
And a personal anecdote, I went to London once, and straight from the airport, I took a black cab because I wanted to have the iconic experience, as Sadiq Khan called it, the mayor. But it was pretty incredible. I get into this cab, I say an address. Guy doesn't ask for any directions, doesn't put anything into a GPS. He just knows where it is. And that is the result of the 3 to 5 test, you could argue. And it's certainly a benefit that taxi drivers in London know the city very well and they can get around and they don't only rely on GPS. But is it reasonable in an era of widespread GPS to require people to know all this stuff? Is it reasonable that they even have to speak English? I mean, one of the brilliant things about Uber is it transcends language barriers. I've traveled to countries where I did not share a language with my Uber driver, but it was not a problem at all.
Yeah, there's a lot of these questions about why are we doing this? If Uber's serving customers perfectly well in a way that they obviously like, looking at the company's massive growth in London, why do you need to make them more like black cabs? Sure, it helps to have someone know everything in the city, but when you have to spend that long studying, I mean, it is a full-time job for 3 to 5 years to study this on the off chance that you'll pass, that's going to make the rides more expensive. So is it really any wonder that people who maybe aren't the high income, you know, finance people living in London can't afford to take black cabs all over? And also, if you're not in central London, these cabs aren't easy to come by. It's kind of like what we see in New York City, where the yellow taxis, it's actually fairly simple to get him in downtown and midtown Manhattan. I don't tell anyone, but I've even taken a yellow cab the last time I was in New York, just because in Manhattan, it's simpler. But when you're out in Queens or the Bronx, similarly, if you're south of London, it's a lot more difficult to find a black cab. So keeping Uber as it is and allowing it to grow and meet consumers' needs is something Khan should have looked at instead of trying to make the two services as one.
Well, this is a heavily regulated industry, as you've indicated, and government's always played a strong role. And now that you have competitions from Uber, you mentioned two other platforms in an op-ed that will be coming out later this week in National Review, so listeners look out for that. There's also Kabee, BlaBlaCar, there are these apps. And is the competition making the taxi industry suffer? And is it inappropriate for government to intervene? Maybe is there a better way to help out the taxi industry?
Well, I think one thing we can look at is a lot of the services in London will even operate from city to city transport. There was always a strong for-hire vehicle market, just like in a lot of large U.S. cities where you could call up a private car and they'd come and get you. But again, what Uber and these new platform services have done is lower the cost and make it a reality for people of all incomes. But I think the way we should look at this moving forward with regulation is instead of trying to make the two the same or applying a lot of the same requirements that go for ride sharing to or that go to the black cabs to ride sharing, we should look at getting rid of some of the restrictions that make black cabs so expensive. Their licensing fees, as we mentioned, the long time you have to spend training, the expensive cabs they have to buy when you could use your own personal vehicle instead. The list goes on and on of ways that you can have smarter regulation that will bring down costs rather than regulating for the sake of doing so.
To play devil's advocate, those measures might help the next generation of black taxis, but you've just pointed out a bunch of sunk costs. I've already spent 3 to 5 years taking tests. That opportunity cost is massive. Just imagine what I could have been doing with that time. I've already spent a bunch of money on licensing fees. Is there anything the government can do to level the playing field in a retroactive way? I bring up the word bailout. I mean, libertarians are probably going to go crazy right now. But if you sold a bunch of these drivers a false bill of goods, you basically said, look, you're going to get in here. You're going to study your ass off. If you pass, you're going to be insulated from competition because it is a monopoly. Clearly, that is no longer the case. So these people all invested time and money in something that wasn't what it turned out to be. And that's partly government's fault. Should we be bailing these people out so that they can lower their fares and compete with Uber? I mean, the things that you suggested might help future generations, but what about the current black taxi cab who's struggling because of competition?
Well, one thing I think we need to keep in mind is when we're discussing London, there's not a strict medallion requirement. They have to pay for licenses, but there's not specifically a cap, though the new plan wants to raise it, sets the target for about 20% more licenses. So you don't have the perpetual monopoly that you'll see in New York. It's more of short-term 3 to 5 year licenses. So I don't think the bailout really applies when we're talking about London. For example, if you went and spent years getting trained as a financial planner, and then all of a sudden people start moving to online tools that are cheaper and allow them to keep more of their money, you don't get a bailout.
So there's always a risk that your industry is going to be disrupted, whether you're a cab driver, whether you're, a bookkeeper. When Microsoft Excel was invented, there's always the chance that technology is just going to come and take your job. And maybe the point is that this industry shouldn't get special treatment just because Uber is such a high profile tech policy issue.
Yeah. And as I said before, there were still prearranged rides with people calling it up on their phone. All Uber and other ride sharing companies did was make that far more efficient. So the black cabs, the yellow taxis in New York City, they haven't even lost their special privilege that medallions or licenses give them. What's happened is people just have different preferences, and I don't think you should get a bailout with changing consumer preferences.
What about this nostalgia argument? I mean, it's not necessarily the most sophisticated, but the last line of your op-ed is, policymakers should realize that the London black cab, similar to the red telephone box, might best serve residents as a quaint curbside novelty. Are you suggesting that the cabs just park themselves and act like paperweights? I mean, unlike the telephone booth, which remains even if no one uses it, what the hell are you going to do with all these cabs?
Well, I think one thing you can look at is, this might be a bit of an exaggeration, but like taking the horse carriages in New York City's Central Park, maybe you can pay more and have this uncomfortable experience of riding in a black cab in a few years when you want to go do that. But in all seriousness, the black cabs could still play a role. I mean, they're fairly highly utilized in London right now for the same reason that I said. If you're downtown, it's a busy day, and you can pretty often, if it's not raining, step outside and just grab one.
And if cost is not an option, let's say you're a wealthier person, maybe a wealthy tourist, I mean, that extra 5 to 10 minutes you have to wait for an Uber as opposed to just hailing a cab, maybe that's the difference.
Yeah,
I mean, even I wanted to ride in one just because of the nostalgia. I mean, it was like, I got to try out the black cab. I only did it once because the cost was exorbitant and I saved money on Uber the rest of the time I was there. Sorry, Mr. Mayor. But, you know, it was fun that one time. I felt like, and it was an authentic London experience. So maybe you're right. Maybe it will remain as this kind of luxury experience.
Yeah. So, you know, if they can compete and update their services, as we've seen, taxis all over the U.S. have actually increased in customer service if you look at the level of complaints that cities have received. And that's pretty clearly an Uber effect, because when you face competition, all of a sudden you're forced to get better. I know when I was in London, I had the cab driver charge me 3 times, but he kept saying my credit card wasn't going through. I had no recourse to deal with it afterwards when I looked at my bank statement. If that happened with Uber, not that it even could, I'd get my money right back. So the idea that the mayor, who shares this longing nostalgia for things that he thinks are cute, that should not be driving policy. It should be what consumers decide.
And I can sympathize with the mayor in one regard. He says he doesn't want the cabs to end up like the red telephone booths. Well, my American friend who lives in London has told me that the red telephone booths are the most widespread public urinals that are unauthorized in London. So that if you are a tourist, you best stay outside of the booth when you take a picture, because inside, it's not so great. So I could see why the mayor doesn't want the black cabs to turn into urinals, but maybe there are other ways to help out this industry.
And one more thing I should point out is the tired argument that Uber leads to traffic congestion was used again by the mayor in his plan. There was no link to a study that would look at this. And the last time we saw a high profile claim of traffic congestion in New York City, even the city itself, after studying the data, had to say that Uber does not affect traffic congestion.
Yeah, that backfired. They tried to do a study that would tell them what they wanted to hear. And I guess they were too honest in the way they conducted the study, because the results did not justify them at all. So what do you see happening in London? I mean, is Uber going to fight back against this? Is there recourse? One other thing that we didn't get to. We talked about how Uber is going to be slapped with new regulations, but part of this is actually easing things for taxis. So you have expanded access to bus lines, subsidies for the black cabs. Is that an appropriate way of leveling the playing field? What do you think about those handouts, for lack of a better word, to the taxi industry?
Well, they're going to get about $80 million US to make their fleet greener. And that's just putting more mandates on the taxis that you have to buy expensive cabs. The cabs already cost about $50,000 US. So
that's insane.
Yeah, it's very expensive. I mean, you could buy a high-end car for that price. Yeah. So I don't think that's the way to go. The bus lanes, we could have a discussion about that. If they're being underutilized, maybe that's something you could do. Maybe open it up for ride sharing, though that could be harder to police.
Yeah.
It's something that, you know what, that's not the end of the world. But what we see in the future is it's only going to get worse, because the things we talked about right now are what are going to go into effect. But the 27-point plan is filled with investigate the feasibility of, or evaluate if this is possible. And that means it's going to happen. They're going to take more actions to make it harder for ride sharing to compete.
What recourse does a company like Uber have, you know, other than trying to get maybe some preemption from the national government in London? What are they doing to fight back? I mean, we've seen them fight tooth and nail in certain places and succeed. So what are they responding to? How are they responding to London?
I'm not sure what the British government would be able to do to supersede London's regulations. But what I expect they're going to do is push a public campaign to show that Khan isn't going to be able to get away with this, and at least make it so it can't get any worse. Kind of what they've done in cities where they've just brought awareness to their riders and say, these changes are going to come. You're going to have to wait longer. Your rides are going to be more expensive. Besides that, though, I'm just upset to see London fall when it was such a great city for ride sharing.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things that benefits Uber as a company is that all of its riders and drivers can serve as lobbyists. They can, when it's very real when regulation impacts them, and it's very immediate. It's not just a theoretical thing. So when it happens, people get fired up. And we saw the mayor in New York City have to back down on some of his restrictions that he wanted to put on Uber, because Uber made a brilliant public effort that utilized their riders. So let's move on to Canada, to Montreal, continuing with our American expert here in international policy. So what's going on in Montreal, Jared? I mean, it started out really bad, and then You characterized it as a win in an op-ed for Forbes that we linked to in the show notes. Summarize the situation up in Quebec.
So Quebec went far further than Khan would have ever dreamed of, or any mayor in the U.S. What he tried to do was make Uber exactly like taxis, make them have to purchase the permits to be able to operate the medallions, which have protected the Montreal cab market since 1973. And I don't think it's any coincidence that over that time, Montreal now has the seventh highest taxi fares in the whole world. So this is an area that desperately needs Uber. I mean, look at all the business tourists, the people coming over the summer. And this fight was happening right before the summer season. But the Liberal Party in Quebec actually had an open revolt among its own members because the Liberal Party was pushing this, known as Bill 100. And the young people simply said, no, this is not what we want our party to stand for.
Would that be similar to the old left in the Democratic Party, like your Robert Reich, clashing with younger Democrats who use the services? There's a generational gap, and this party is most similar to the Democratic Party in the U.S.?
Yeah, I would say that's what's going on right now, is the young people simply are saying, why would you ever take this away from us? They have no allegiance to the taxis. They've grown up with being able to just get rides by pushing a button. They don't want to go back to paying the seventh highest fares in the world. But also what was happening is Montreal's taxi medallions were about $200,000 to be able to operate. They've since fallen and are now well below $150,000 after what I'll get to, a deal was reached that allowed Uber to keep operating. But could you imagine being a college student in one of Montreal's many universities or Quebec cities and have to go and buy a $200,000 medallion to be able to drive Uber for a few hours on the weekend? I mean, this would have killed the industry. And Uber even said it will, if this bill would have gone through, it would have pulled out of Montreal.
Yeah, and don't take their threats lightly, because we saw that in Austin, where it wasn't even that type of regulation. It was a fingerprinting requirement that caused them to leave. So they will make good on their threats. This is tens of billions of dollars this company is worth, and they can afford to pull out of a city on principle or for business reasons. And, you know, mayors and city councils must take note of that, because you can't just do whatever you want.
Yeah, and I think the funniest part of this regulation is the transportation minister who was pushing it, Doust is his last name. He had actually never taken Uber. So a reporter asked him, how can you ban something you've never even ridden in? And he says, well, you know, you don't have to try drugs to ban them. So apparently he thinks Uber's as bad as heroin. But it was a clear case of where the socialist wing of the party and the older members of the Liberal Party were against innovation and trying to stand for established interests, whereas the younger members said, no, we're going to fight this. And the younger members ended up winning in the end. There was a 90-day delay where Uber was allowed to keep operating and kind of work on some compromise with the government. And then on the very last day, newspapers were already writing articles and published articles saying that no truce was reached. A deal was reached at the very last minute. So Uber still operates there right now.
What do we think about this deal? Because we've seen Uber have to settle lawsuits, make concessions in certain jurisdictions in the United States. We've seen deals that were praised by the company, but, you know, lambasted by free marketers. What do you think of this deal? I mean, is this something to celebrate because it provides certainty and allows the industry to operate? Or is this merely just extortion?
Well, it was a bad deal, but overall, looking at what was happening and the reality in Montreal, I billed it as a win for Forbes, because it was, you know, Uber was that close to being completely wiped out in Montreal, and you had such an established industry that the first chip in the armor, which I think there are going to be a lot more coming to in Montreal, it was the hardest to get.
And is this the goal? Is this the playbook now? I mean, you could see how there's a lesson to be learned from this. If you're a public policy person or a lawmaker and you really want to go after Uber, do you start out with something so absurd that by the time you reach a deal, it looks good in comparison to the crap that they started with? I mean, is this the strategy? Move the goalposts so far to the left that when we reach some type of deal, even when it's a crappy deal, we say it's a win?
Yeah, that's what we saw in Massachusetts, where the taxis wanted an outright ban. And then you had the Republican governor signing a bill that put a tax on Uber and other ride-sharing companies and directly transferred part of that tax to the taxi industry.
Republicans signing on to wealth redistribution. That's fun.
Yeah, but if you look at it, I mean, Uber and Lyft both hailed the deal in Massachusetts as a win. I mean, I didn't like it personally because I had higher hopes for Massachusetts. But the reason I liked this one was because you were starting at such an uphill battle that I was just surprised Uber wasn't all out banned or treat it exactly like taxis.
Well, the Red Sox just got swept in the first round of the playoffs, so karma's a bitch, right?
But one of the weirdest things we see in Montreal, though, is they build it as the same thing as a medallion requirement without making drivers get a medallion. So what happens is the first 50,000 miles that, 50,000 miles that a company operates, they have to pay a 68-cent fee per ride to the city. So, and then this goes as a way to kind of be like medallions. And then if you go up more, you know, 50 to 100,000 goes up to 84 cents, then it goes up to 96 cents. And they haven't figured out the level above 150,000 miles yet, but it's something that you're seeing this idea of placing extra fees to maybe compensate the losers or just to penalize the service and try to make them more equal in cost, which was another part of the Montreal bill, putting minimum fare requirements. I mean, nothing like protecting the public by making them pay more.
And this really just runs antithetical to the model because Uber does have full-time drivers. A lot of them are taxi drivers who have converted, but most of them are part-time. So in trying to impose these kinds of requirements, you are going to incentivize people to be locked into this job. And one of the benefits of the sharing economy, the gig economy, whatever you want to call it, is flexibility. The idea that I could drive for Uber today, I can drive for Lyft tomorrow, I can deliver for Postmates, I can drive for Instacart. You don't want to be locked in. But if you're going to have to pay medallion fees and take tests and all this stuff, you're going to be much more likely to remain in the job because you don't want to waste all that time and money you spent. So it really shows a lack of understanding about how this works if they keep trying to fit the square peg of the taxi industry into the round hole of ride sharing.
Yeah, and just think, when driverless cars end up picking up, who knows if that'll be in a decade, 2 decades from now. I mean, people aren't going to still be driving for Uber. This is something that people are taking opportunities that are available for them because they have low barriers to entry, an ability to work when they want, an ability to earn money with assets they're not using or their time. So trying to legislate the current model, which is something policymakers always try to do, that's not a winning strategy, especially in our age of technological change.
Well, Jared, thanks so much for joining the show. You've got an op-ed in Forbes about the Montreal situation, which we link to in the show notes today. And you've also got an op-ed in National Review coming out about the London situation. So look out for that. Thanks again.
Hey, thanks for having me, Evan.
Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Tech Freedom. Send us an email, media@techfreedom.org. Let us know what you think of the show. Feel free to pitch topics and guests. Find this podcast in the iTunes store where you can leave us a review because it will help others find the show. Thanks for listening.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.